You're hearing voices.
My mom is close to 90 years old, but she still likes to travel. She likes to think about traveling anyway.
From NPR, this is Hearing Voices.
Hey, Margie, was it hard the first time Mubarak gave you a shower?
All mom radio.
I got embarrassed.
Motherly tales from around the country.
How did you get over being embarrassed?
Just because it happens over and over and over again. But it's my son, you know.
A Hearing Voices special.
Bingo is serious business. It spells money. The women, mostly ex-factory workers like my mother, had sat hunched over tables in a smoke-choked room, concentrating hard as their arms flew across boards that stretched 2 feet in both directions. When some poor woman yelled for the caller to please repeat a number, a bingo player at our table mumbled, "Tell her to turn her hearing aid up."
Oh, 65.
Bingo.
All mom read. From HearingVoices.com. From NPR, I'm Barrett Golding of Hearing Voices, the best of public radio, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts.
So I'm an adult, okay? You know, I have a job, my own apartment, but my mother still doesn't seem to realize that I'm capable of taking care of some really very basic needs.
Hi, Amala. It's me, honey. If you haven't already left to go to the Motor Vehicle Bureau, keep in mind that the wait is very long. So before you get in line, you may want to empty your bladder. All right, honey? That's all for now. Bye-bye.
That's off the CD Amy's Answering Machine. For more than a decade, New York City comedian Amy Borkowski has been saving her mom's phone messages.
Amala? I hope you're on your way home. I just heard on the weather there's a big storm headed for New York, and they're expecting 4 to 6 inches in the city, with accumulations of up to a foot in the outlying areas. So if I were you, I wouldn't go schlepping to any outlying areas. On the weather map, all over New York, they had snowflakes the size of bagels. So if you have to go out, make sure you bundle up and wrap a scarf around your face to protect it. Because, you know, there was that man who climbed Mount Everest and lost his entire nose. Okay, honey. Bye-bye.
From HearingVoices.com, you're listening to All Mom Radio, a collection of motherly stories from producers around the country. We've got a lot of moms to visit in this next hour, so let's get going. The first few stops, bingo night with Beverly D'Onofrio's mom. And right now, we're off with Larry Massett on his travels with mom.
My mom is close to 90 years old, but she still likes to travel. She likes to think about traveling anyway. When I'm going down to Savannah for a visit, we often plan out a trip. We talk on the phone about driving to Florida, Jacksonville maybe, or SeaWorld, or even the Keys. Yeah, she says, that would be fun. On the phone, it sounds like her bags are packed. But when I walk in her front door, it's a different story. There are no suitcases in sight, just a styrofoam cooler. That's the clue. It means where we're really going is the local beach, Tybee Island, half an hour away. This is where we always go.
So we're not going to go to Florida, huh?
No.
You don't want to go?
No, I don't travel very well. You don't have the energy. You know, the waiting, you're just, I guess you get to the point where you go more for comfort than anything else, and you're just better off to stay in your own environment.
Her environment these days is a cottage in a retirement community. Lots of pine trees and mockingbirds and air conditioners humming away and a whiff of disinfectant in the air.
Take a look in the kitchen. There are 13 bottles that I would have to cart along.
Them.
Some you take before a meal, some you'd have to take after, and it just makes traveling difficult.
If you look out the window, you can almost see, you can't quite see, the building where they put you when you can't take care of yourself anymore. If you can't sit up, They strap you to your wheelchair. You can't see that from here, but you can feel it, like an undertow.
I don't get lonely. I don't get bored. For the past 2 years, all of my spare time has been spent in helping my niece take care of my sister. She's had two strokes. And she's recovered physically, but mentally, she still has problems. And I don't think it will ever be any better. The only thing I can do with her is to reminisce. She wants to talk about when we were growing up, and we've covered that over and over. So there are a lot of things I probably would still be doing except for my sister's illness. So that has changed my life more than anything.
We're going to go to the beach now. Tell me what we're packing.
Just some drinks.
Just what's in here?
Some drinks.
Just
wait a minute, look right there. Let's don't get into that. There's some that's just fruit.
Okay.
There are some strawberries and some pears in there.
Are we gonna take these along?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I thought we'd go up on the pavilion and have a picnic.
That's great. Okay. We're gonna travel.
Yeah, we're gonna travel.
Go to the beach.
Okay.
My mom travels in a semi-retired Oldsmobile stuffed to the gills with Kleenex. It would rather head for the nearest shopping mall, but it can eventually be coaxed onto the road to Tybee.
At one time, this Palm Line Drive went all the way from Savannah to the ocean. Gradually, over the years, the palms have died down and they haven't been replaced, but it was all the way. You just see water everywhere as we're going out here. Marshland.
It's real swamp, it's real road.
Mm-hmm.
The road keeps bridging creeks and inlets. A lot of bridges out here, a lot of islands.
There's so many, I don't know the names of them. A lot of water out here. And the railroad used to come, that's the railroad bed. There where you see all the trees. When I was a child, we came to the beach by railroad. Come to this bend up here, you can see the water. We're almost in the ocean. If you go straight, you'd be right in it.
Tybee is a few miles long, a mile wide or so. Along the beach, condos are sprouting up, but it's still mostly bungalows. In my mother's time, people came here for the ocean air, and on Saturday nights, they came to dance at the pavilion. They say they had big-name bands like Guy Lombardo. This is where we're headed. First, though, my mom wants me to turn off the main drag onto a side lane. We wind up in a place I don't know. There are big old wooden buildings, one after the other in a line, like army barracks.
We're at Fort Scriven. Where I worked in 1935 in this building and worked as a secretary in there. And this is where I was working when your dad and I were married. We had to get married because he was going broke running down here from Atlanta every weekend. He was working for the Forest Service in Atlanta. And I was War Department here. And at that time, husband and wife were not allowed to work for the government. So we were married secretly in September because I wanted to continue my job for the rest of the year, which I did, because we needed the money.
I hope the government doesn't hear this on the
radio. Yeah, they never catch up with us.
Imagine that. My mom with a secret husband. My mom with no money. Mom at age 20. What else has she forgotten to mention? We drive around hunting for the house she lived in when she worked here, but nothing looks the same. It's no use. So we give up and drive to a house we can find, the one we all lived in when I was 4 or 5.
Here we are. There's our mansion. Well, Larry, they've kept it up.
It's a beach cottage, set 10 feet off the ground on pilings. I recall it was pretty big. Today, oddly enough, it has shrunk to the size of a doghouse. A few tiny rooms where my mother and her sister lived with the husbands and relatives and kids and dogs and all. A porch runs around 3 sides.
Yeah, everybody pretty much spent the whole evening out on the porch.
The porch goes all the way around the house. And we sometimes would sleep out there at night. We didn't have any air conditioning.
Sure, I remember. My Aunt Grace, the one who's had a stroke, I remember her on the porch at night when the women played canasta. She had a deep tan and long, really long legs and red lipstick, and she laughed a lot and smoked cigarettes that were spelled Pall Mall but pronounced Pall Mall. And when she said, "I wonder if someone could freshen my drink," every man in the room jumped. But the porch is empty now. So I say, "Hey, isn't it time to get to the pavilion?"
Okay.
Okay, finally we're getting out of the car. Downtown Tybee is surfboards, motorcycles, and beer joints. And sex. Everyone looks to be 18 years old and stark naked. Apparently, there's a fad for flesh-colored bikinis. The pavilion is just a fishing pier, but the front is built in a wide circle with a roof overhead. This is where the big bands used to play. Actually, the old pavilion burned down years ago. This is a new one. And for some reason, they put in a cement floor, which turns it into an echo chamber. It's jammed full of picnic tables and screaming kids and vending machines. It doesn't feel like Guy Lombardo at all. Nonetheless, my mom sits down peacefully with her bottled water and her pear. She's having a picnic. Doesn't she see these naked people, all these flesh-colored girls? Is she filtering it? Is she setting the clock back to 1935? Where is she going? Now we're back from the beach, and we're sitting around eating shrimp in my Aunt Grace's backyard.
Something we never missed was going to the pavilion to dance on Saturday night. Grace was a great dancer. She liked dancing much more than I did, and she could dance from the first dance until they played Goodnight Ladies. She never missed a dance. She was a beautiful dancer. Grace, do you remember dancing at Tybee?
Oh, of course I remember those happy days. Oh, we used to have name time bands. Galavardo was there one time.
Yeah,
you would put on our best bib and tucker, evening dress that was, and danced all night as long as they'd stay there. The orchestra would stay with us. Whatever the music, wherever it went, we went too.
And then after the dance, you'd go wading in the ocean with your beautiful evening dress. Yeah, I remember.
I did. I was a bad girl.
She was a fun-loving girl, fun lover. You had fun.
Yes, I had fun. I'll never forget those days.
And it occurs to me we're traveling right now, here in the backyard. Not in space, which requires too much Kleenex after a certain age, too many bottles of pills, but in time. That road's always open, isn't it? Memory Lane is no footpath. It's the interstate. It's fast, it's free, and the older you get, the farther it goes. And the road always goes just where you want it to go, and all your friends along. What a bargain.
Flamingo. I'd heard about it since I was 9 or 10. I remember distinctly sitting on the sofa and closing my eyes hard, wishing my mother would win some money. Once she actually won $100, which to my mind was the same as $10,000. It would change our lives, I was certain. It actually did for maybe a week. Usually harried and unhappy, my mother was lighthearted. She sang to the radio. She smiled.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Elsie.
Hi. Hi, Bill.
This is Sophie, my daughter Beverly.
Hi.
It's Thursday, bingo night at the Polish American Hall. We, my mother and I, are in my hometown, Wallingford, Connecticut. There are a lot of factories and car dealerships here, and women about my mother's age, over 60, who have a thing for bingo. My mother plays 3 times a week. Tonight she lays out $15 for bingo cards. So what should I buy here?
I would just give her 2 of each. She's never played before, so it's the first time.
Actually, it wasn't my first time. I'd played before, once, 5 years ago, in a failed attempt to feel closer to my mother. I'd expected to find a room full of warm, chummy older ladies trading stories about their grandkids. Was I off the mark? Bingo is serious business. It spells money. The women, mostly ex-factory workers like my mother, had sat hunched over tables in a smoke-choked room, concentrating hard as their arms flew across boards that stretched 2 feet in both directions. When some poor woman yelled for the caller to please repeat a number, a bingo player at our table mumbled, "Tell her to turn her hearing aid up." I pled a headache and went home early. I mean, these were grandmothers. Even my mother admits her bingo cronies can be nasty.
Not all of them are rude, but the majority of them are.
This is my daughter, Beverly.
Hi, Beverly.
Hi, how do you do?
So, what's new?
I just brought my husband home from the hospital, and yeah? I said, let me get out of here.
This time, the atmosphere is different. The people seem social, the room not nearly so crowded or smoky. The big money games have moved to other clubs. The women who remain do so out of habit or because they like the company.
Good evening. Welcome to Thursday night at the bingo. First is the green quickie. Blue, sorry.
There are around 40 women seated in clusters here and there at long cafeteria tables. On stage is an electronic bingo board, and next to it is a box of bouncing ping pong balls.
17. 23. 71.
The women have bags with bingo stenciled or embroidered across them. They carry their chips in plastic Tupperware containers. They line good luck trolls along the edge of their boards and check the time on bingo watches. My mother's knowledge is incredible. She can predict the exact number on which bingo will be called every time. She's even right about Bertha, a woman who has a tendency to accidentally call bingo when she doesn't really have it. It happens on the very first game.
18.
Hi.
No, we fill the card.
That's the woman I was telling you.
Oh. My mother and her bingo partner Vivian pull magnetic wands from their bags and sweep up their metal chips.
They think we're nuts. They're laughing, see? I like to see them at our age.
A few times, my mother leans across and places a chip on a number I missed. There was a time not so long ago when her solicitousness would have driven me mad. I would have hissed, "Mom, I can do it myself." Now it makes me feel looked after.
55.
Under G.
Under O.
G. 55.
20.
I.
It's odd, but I was actually having fun. By the end of the evening, I'd even won $10. I groaned with everyone else when someone yelled bingo and didn't think myself rude at all. I could imagine that if I'd never moved away, I might go with my mother once a week. I'd sit next to her, our arms touching like they were now. When I was little and would roll my eyes at every word out of my mother's mouth, when I'd make fun of her dress and imitate her speech, she'd turn to me and say, "One day we'll be best friends, you wait." It never happened. But I'll tell you, there's nothing like touching shoulders with someone who wants you to win as much or more than she wants to win herself. Except maybe touching shoulders with someone you feel the same way about. She may not be my best friend. She's closer than that. She's my mother.
Oh, 65.
Bingo.
Same winners.
12, 19, 49, 65.
Same winners.
Okay.
Same winners.
Got it.
writer Beverly D'Onofrio's Thursday Night Bingo, produced by David Isay of soundportraits.org. And Larry Massett's Travels with Mom is part of the HearingVoices.com radio project.
Hi, Amala, it's me. You know the red terry robe you wore when I came to visit? It's like a ruby red with a belt. Do you still wear that, or did you throw it out? I just want to tell you that if you take out the garbage or run to the mailbox, you may want to put on something else, because my friend Eileen's grandson said that red is a gang color. Okay, sweetie pie? Talk to you later.
That's off comedian Amy Borkowski's CD, Amy's Answering Machine, Messages from Mom. Available at her website, sendamy.com.
Yeah, hello, Amala. They just said on TV it's 10 p.m. Do you know where your children are? And I'm thinking, I don't know, so I figured I'd call you, Mama Shanks. You must be in the bathroom or something. Give me a buzz when you're done, okay? All right, bye-bye. Amala. It's 5 to 11, and I know you have to work tomorrow. I'm getting a little worried. Call me when you get this message, honey, okay? Bye-bye.
Hi, Amy. It's Michael. It's like 11:30-something, I think. I don't know. I just got woken up. Your mom actually called me and wanted to know where you are.
Hi, Amy, it's Sharon. You know, your mother just called me. She's really worried about you.
Hey, Aim, it's Les. Your mother just called. She doesn't know where you are.
Amy, it's Allison. I just got home. I have 7 messages on my machine from your mother.
Hi, Amy, yeah, it's Andrew. I just got a call from your mom about 10 minutes ago, and she wanted to know if you were spending the night at my house. I told her we broke up 4 years ago.
Hello, Miss Borkowski. Hi, I'm calling from NYU Hospital. Someone called here claiming to be your mother and wanting to know if you had been admitted.
Next up, a gay man goes home to help with his ailing mom and his homophobic family. We're back in a minute with more All Mom Radio from HearingVoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
From HearingVoices.com, you're listening to All Mom Radio, a collection of motherly stories from producers around the country.
With my mother, anything that happens to, like, even a distant cousin somehow has an immediate bearing on my health.
Yay, Mila. It's only me. I don't know if you heard that cousin Myron passed the kidney stone, and the doctors told him it's from not drinking enough water, which is why I'm telling you. Remember, honey, you're not a camel. They say that passing a stone feels like you're giving birth. And if you're going to go through all that, I'd like to end up with something that can call me grandma. Okay, honey? Bye-bye.
That's off comedian Amy Borkowski's CD, Amy's Answering Machine, Messages from Mom. Available at her website, sendamy.com.
You know, people are always debating whether it's harmful for kids to watch too much TV, but I think the biggest problem is what happens when your parents watch too much TV.
Amala, I just talked to you. Where did you go? Anyway, I forgot to tell you. I was watching the news, and they had a story about the Hells Angels Motorcycle Club. and they flashed a shot of a big bear of a guy from Greenwich Village who was covered in tattoos. And on the back of his motorcycle was a very pretty girl. And I meant to ask, was that you? She had your hair, and she was wearing a green blouse that looked like the one I gave you for Hanukkah. I'm hoping it was just a coincidence, because you know how I feel about motorcycles. Do me a favor, Amy. If you have such ants in your pants, like you want to go for a ride, it can be just as exciting to go in a cab. Okay, keep your wits about you, honey. Bye.
The next piece is from This American Life producer, Nancy Updike. She calls it Mubarak and Margie.
This story is like one of those Russian dolls where there's always a smaller one inside. The smallest doll, the core of the drama, is the fact that Mubarak, a childhood sissy, grew up to be a different kind of sissy than his father. His father is nerdy and bookish. Mubarak's gay. Everything around that core gets bigger and bigger until finally you can't believe the biggest and the smallest have anything to do with each other. The one is so bloated and the other so tiny. At the beginning of this story, Mubarak's parents are married and in love, and both prepare to live far from everything they know to be with each other. At the end of the story, they may still be in love, but they're divorced and an ocean apart and not speaking. And Mubarak is caring for his mother the way a husband might.
Okay, Margie Ruth.
I don't get too hot.
I'm not going to get too hot.
Mubarak starts Margie's shower, and he's holding on to her so she won't fall. And she's holding on to him, too. She's about 5 feet tall, naked and fragile-looking, and very pale. He's dressed in jeans and a shirt that he knows are about to get really wet.
All right, lift your breast. Lift one at a time so I can wash under it.
Okay. Hey, Margie, was it hard the first time Mubarak gave you a shower?
I got embarrassed.
How did you get over being embarrassed?
I just cause it happens over and over and over again. But it's my son, you know.
He gets a washcloth in under her breasts, and she stands serenely, blinking in the water. It's a moment so intimate it's hard to watch. But then, as he gets her out of the shower and is drying her off, there's another moment that makes the intimacy of everything before it seem completely beside the point and prettied up in comparison. He takes a baby wipe and wipes her butt for her.
Nobody's going to give me a shot today, are they?
No, we have to take some blood, though. We have to go to the lab, and they're going to take some blood.
Well, that's a shot.
It's not a shot. They're drawing blood.
Well, they put little...
They stick you, but they're not giving you a shot. They're taking blood. There's a difference.
You ever tried it?
Margie's only 66, but in the last couple of years she's had a heart attack and two small strokes, which paralyzed her right arm and affected her memory. It cuts in and out like faulty wiring. Sometimes she's talkative and remembers a lot. Sometimes she's not, and she doesn't.
Here, you know what? Lift your breast for me again so that we can make sure. You don't have a rash under there anymore, do you?
I don't think so.
Because we got to make sure it stays dry so it doesn't get a rash under there.
Mubarak, is this closer than you ever thought you'd get to an adult woman's body?
you could say that.
But this is the end of the story. This is today. Let's go back to the beginning. Mubarak's family didn't really notice that he was, as he tells it, a big sissy because they were all oddballs. No matter where they were living, at least one of them was always not quite fitting in. Margie's from Georgia and lived most of her married life either up north or in the Middle East. Mubarak's father, Sabr, is Palestinian, born in Jordan, but for most of the marriage, they all lived in a small town in Pennsylvania where he was a professor of civil engineering. Now, if Mubarak was a sissy and white, working-class, Catholic Hershey, PA, Sabr was too.
We got a week off of school every year because so many people, so many boys went deer hunting. And of course, you know, I didn't go hunting and I didn't play any, you know, football, and I didn't do all of those things that, you know, the boys in the neighborhood were supposed to do, especially hunting. Hunting was like, you know, a a yardstick of when you reached manhood.
Sabir, meanwhile, to Mubarak's shame and horror, had to call in neighborhood dads to do simple mechanical tasks like unclogging a drain. And Margie was the one who hung their wedding pictures because Sabir claimed he didn't know how to hammer a nail.
No, Sabir didn't do any of that stuff. I mean, Sabir was always very formal. He always had a sport jacket. I remember, like, cutting grass was a big deal out there. Like, lawn care, like, how green and how even and how perfect was your yard. And then I remember Sabir was in the yard cutting the grass. And he was cutting the grass and he had a sport coat and a tie on. Which is funny, I mean, if you think about it.
Well, and why would he do it?
I mean, I think that came from the Middle East idea that if you are educated, that there's a certain position that you have in society and that you should always look and act a certain way.
You can see why, in this atmosphere, Sabir at one point panicked and made Margie sign Mubarak up for Little League. To toughen him up, he told her. But mostly, Margie says, Sabir worshipped Mubarak. He adored him.
Mubarak this and Mubarak that and Mubarak the other, and everything he talked about was Mubarak. After he found out Bark was gay, he hardly ever said he wouldn't hardly even mention his name.
Margie was the one who made the phone call to Mubarak after finding a bunch of gay adult cards in his room. He was 20 years old and staying with friends in Germany at the time on his way to a semester in England.
And it was the middle of the night. I don't remember if we were exactly in bed. And the mother came down and said in German to my friend, there's a phone call from America and it's an emergency for your American friend. So I was all nervous and I went upstairs and it was Margie and she was crying. She was hysterical. And she said, I said, Margie, what's wrong? And she said, you have to come home now. And I said, why? What's wrong? And she just kept repeating, you have to come home now. And I kept trying to get out of her what was wrong. So she finally said, we found a good hospital in Tennessee that can cure you. And then I knew what was wrong. And of course, I told her that I wasn't coming home until the end of the semester, and I would see her in January, and I think I hung up right away.
This was the beginning of their world starting to shift and become something else. Sabir blamed Margie for Mubarak being gay. Sabir, who never raised his voice before, would pound the table and say Mubarak was gay because he's a mama's boy.
I didn't think I'd married the same person at those times. He used to be jolly and gay and cheerful and tell jokes and I didn't know him anymore. I guess he didn't know me either.
He was in such bad shape that he had taken off time from the university. I think he took a whole semester off from teaching at the university. He was so bad at one point, he would sit and like stare into space and not respond to conversations and questions. And they had like home health care, like an IV for him at home because he wouldn't eat.
When Mubarak came home around Christmas, they all sat down at the kitchen table for a family meeting.
Margie didn't say hardly anything the whole time. And neither did I, actually. Sabir did most of the talking. And he said, basically he started with, you know, you're our son and we love you, but this is wrong, and this is an illness, and there are doctors, you know, I've looked into it, and there are doctors who say that if you just try, if you get help, that you can change, you know.
Did he say the word homosexual?
Oh, God, no, he would never say that. He would say, your condition, or your problem, or your situation. He would never say the word gay or homosexual, ever, ever, ever. Like, even in the years after that, he never, ever said that word.
The biggest problem with Mubarak being gay was that he would never have children. He would never have a son to carry on the family name, as Sabr had done, and as Sabr's father had done. This was Mubarak's obligation. After a long argument, the last thing Sabr said to Mubarak was this.
I remember he said, he looked at me and he said, I will sell all the land in Palestine to raise the money to send you to a doctor if you ever decide that you would go. And that's if you being Palestinian and understanding how important land is, I mean, land is identity, it's a future, it's the past, it's everything. And for Sabr to say that he would sell all of his land showed that this was really the top priority in his whole life.
For 2 years, nothing changed. Mubarak stayed in school and kept being gay. Sabr stayed depressed and wrote Mubarak long letters saying he loved Mubarak, but Mubarak was sick and he owed it to Sabr to get help. Margie quietly began flooding Mubarak's college mailbox with condoms. Then Margie and Sabr moved back to the Middle East, as they'd always planned to do when Sabr retired. He was 65, she was 59. 6 months later, everything shifted again. The family mutated again, becoming more like what it would soon be, and less like it had been before. It started with another phone call to Mubarak.
Well, I mean, the way I first found out about it was I got a telephone call one afternoon from Margie. And she said, honey, do you think I could come live with you? And I didn't know what she was talking about. I said, Margie, what are you talking about? She said, do you think I could come live with you? And then she told me that she and Sabr were getting divorced because he was going to marry another woman and have another son.
In fact, divorce wasn't even what Sabr wanted. At first, he asked Margie if she would be his partner in what he called
joint venture. I want you to help me find a young lady you think you can get along with. I said, what?
And he said, I want to marry another woman and have a baby.
I said, okay, Sabr. You better find one you think you can get along with, because I'm not going to be here.
And then, you know, she went through that was plan A, and the plan B was having another wife at a different apartment. And then plan C was him getting married in the West Bank, just going down there a couple weeks a year, and then basically living with Margie and Jordan. And her response to that was always my favorite. That's when she asked him. She said, okay, that's fine, as long as I can have a
boyfriend. He said, why? I said, so when you ask me what I've been doing, I'll tell you the same thing you've been doing while you were over there. He didn't appreciate that either.
And I remember Sabr wrote me a very, very long letter explaining what he was doing and why he was doing it and how he had been forced into doing this, because for years he had been asking me to go get help, and I was just ignoring him. And he felt that it was his, since I was not going to have a son to carry on the family name, that the responsibility of making sure that the family name survived suddenly became his again. And this was the only way he could see to do it. And he was very heavy on the, this is your fault. You're doing this to Margie, not me. The other thing that was really strange was he spent pages saying, you know, your mother is being very closed-minded about all of this. Try to help me convince her to stay here. She doesn't have to leave. I don't want her to leave.
So Sabr divorced Margie, telling her every day until she left that he loved her and didn't want her to leave. And she got on the plane and began the life she's pretty much living now. From that point on, instead of a husband, she would have a son. And from the moment the plane touched down, he treated her the way you'd want your husband to treat you.
I never forget when I came back getting off the plane. You know, we got through customs and all that stuff. I saw this great big bunch of flowers somebody was holding way up in that beautiful, beautiful bunch of flowers. And I said, somebody is certainly going to get to myself a beautiful bouquet of flowers. And guess who that was?
Well, any guesses? Margie moved into Mubarak's graduate school apartment, which, by the way, was at the same university where Sabir had taught. In her old life, she'd been supported by one man, her husband, the professor. In her new life, she was surrounded by a whole sissy entourage. Mubarak's friends were always coming in and whisking her away to the orchestra, to plays. They adored her. She still cried every day, many times a day, for the first few months. And every day she got at least one letter from Sabir, sometimes two. Finally, one day, the letter that came from Sabir said he'd gotten married. Mubarak, not knowing what was in the letter, gave it to Margie and went to his room.
We came back out. I mean, it was 5 or 10 minutes later. And she was still sitting there, but she had a funny look on her face. So I said, are you okay? And she started saying things like, please don't hurt me, please don't hurt me, and crying. I'm like, Margie, what are you talking about? Don't come any closer, don't come any closer, don't hurt me. And she didn't know who I was. She didn't know who she was.
Just out of it.
Her amnesia, Mubarak calls it a vacation from the bad news, lasted several days.
1, 2, 3.
There you go. It's a good thing for
me. We're in Margie's cardiologist's office, and she's about to surprise me. On the last day I spend with Margie and Mubarak, she suddenly murmurs that she wishes Mubarak had gotten married.
No, I wish you would have married.
You wish that Mubarak would have married?
Mm-hmm.
Who?
Mark Stoner.
Now, most mothers who say, oh, I wish my gay son had gotten married, and you ask them who, they don't say a man.
Mark Stoner.
So you don't wish Mubarak had married any girl that you know?
Mm-mm. I wish he'd have married Mark Stoner. Because he was a nice guy, and he loved Mubarak a lot.
Even after all the time I'd spent with her, I had completely expected her to say a woman's name. Because even though it's common when men come out as gay for their mothers to be more accepting than their fathers, there are usually at least some pretty clear limits for the mothers, too. Certain ways that they're used to seeing the world and just can't give up. But Margie's world and Mubarak's are not really separate, as they are for most gay people and their parents. Mubarak is really glad she's here. He says it all the time. And he spends a lot of time with Margie, willingly, happily. He's the only person I know who seems as unambivalent in his love for his mother as she is in her love for him. Every once in a while, he talks about something I know he thinks about a lot, which is that this is the end of Margie's life. And he's grateful that she's spending it here, where he can be with her.
Okay. Margie?
Hmm?
Are you okay?
Mm-hmm.
You're like wobbling back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Margie? Margie? Margie, talk to me.
What is it, Barker?
What's happening?
While I was taping, Margie had what seemed to be a small stroke.
Margie? Margie? Margie?
Should we call 911, Mubarak?
It all happened in about 2 minutes. Yeah. And when it was over, Margie seemed fine, although disoriented and tired. She couldn't really remember what had happened. We were more shaken than she was. Mubarak and I talked in the kitchen afterward while he made Margie some tea.
It was really scary.
It was just so frightening. Because, you know, it's so scary when you go to the hospital and... I remember the first time I went, and she had congestive heart failure, and you don't know what that means. You know, you hear heart failure, and you panic. And then I remember the other two times, going into the hospital, and thinking, it should be easier this time. But every time it happens, it gets scarier, because you think you're one step closer to something really awful happening. I'm going to be a mess whenever anything really serious happens. we just did that because we knew you were going to be tape recording today. I'm like, Mark, do you think I have a little heart failure this afternoon?
Just do what you can. I mean,
I'm so scared all the time. Anyway.
P.S. It might not be clear from this story, but I think Margie really loved Sauber. I think he really loved her. We saw it clear as day in the pages of her wedding scrapbook. She turns to a picture from her wedding day. Sauber's embracing Margie, and both their eyes are closed. They're smiling. They look completely happy, probably not even aware the picture is being taken.
What were you thinking right at that moment when that was happening?
I got that man. He's mine now. My mother had told me, when you find the right one, you know it. And I did. Well, I thought he was the right one. Turned out he wasn't. I never did find the right one.
Mubarak and Margie, from This American Life producer Nancy Updike. From HearingVoices.com, you're listening to All Mom Radio, motherly tales from around the country.
Hi, Amala. It's me, honey. I was just watching the Maury Povich show, and the whole show was about eligible billionaire bachelors. And one of them in particular, I thought would be perfect for you. He's a millionaire, and he has a house in Italy. And I know how much you love spaghetti. So let me know if I should call the Maury Povich show, okay? Bye.
So I called her back and told her, absolutely do not call the Maury Povich show. And 2 hours later, I get another message.
Yeah, hello, Amala, it's me again. I called the Maury Povich show, and what would be required is to send the Bachelor a video of yourself. So, I had some thoughts, like maybe you could put in a shot of you preparing a chicken, or since they said he's such a big sports fan, you can show yourself by the TV, yelling, let's go Jets! So call me back, Mama Jane.
So I call her and tell her, look, Mom, all right, I don't know this guy. You don't know this guy. Forget it. I'm not going to waste my time making a stupid video. And the next day...
Hi, Amala. I know you're too busy to prepare something to send to the Bachelor, so I did. I sent him the picture of you in the tub when you were two, where you could see your cute tushy. Oh, and that bachelor said he likes a sense of humor. So I put in the picture from your graduation, where you stuck the pillow under your gown so you look like you're pregnant. All right, Mama Shanks. Bye-bye.
That's off comedian Amy Borkowski's CD, Amy's Answering Machine, Messages from Mom.
So my mother lives out of town, and she will use any excuse to finagle her way into coming for a little visit.
Hi, Amala. It's me, honey. I just want to tell you they're having some good airfares to New York, and I was thinking maybe I could come up for a little while. Like for a few months, maybe. I have to go to that store on 3rd Avenue that has the pumpernickel raisin bread that I love. The only place that has it here has also, I don't know, like caraway seeds. Ugh, feh. They gave me a slice. It made me so nauseous. Well, call me back, Mama Shanes. Bye-bye.
All Mom Radio was produced by HearingVoices.com with grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. Thanks to the contributing producers Nancy Updike from This American Life, thislife.org, Larry Massett, story editor for HearingVoices.com, producer David Isay and writer Beverly D'Onofrio from soundportraits.org, and the CD and book of Amy's Answering Machine, Messages from Mom, are available at her website, sendamy.com.
Basically, my mother has no life, okay? I am her entire life, and even a total stranger can pick up on that.
Yeah, hello, Amala, it's me. You remember that program I love to watch with the live psychics? Well, I called up the one gal named Natasha for a reading, and she was absolutely marvelous. The first thing she asked right off the bat was if I had a daughter whose name contained a vowel. She said, like, either an A or an E. And she saw you romantically involved with a very nice guy who may be going bald, but that you shouldn't reject him because of that. Because she said he'll bring you much happiness, and he can always buy a toupee. So that should be some good news for you, honey. Call me when you get in. Love you. Bye.
The HearingVoices.com website is stuffed with more sounds and resources. Also check Transom.org, a workshop and showcase for public radio. Hearing Voices musics are by Skyward and by Racket Ship. I'm Barrett, Claire Golding's son. Hi, Ma. Yeah, I know. I should call more. I will. Really. I promise. I will. Love you, Ma. Bye.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is HearingVoices.com.